Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I'd buy you a house. I would buy you a house. And if I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Buy you furniture for your house. Maybe an ice Chesterfield or an ottoman. And if I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I...
Hello, welcome back, Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures up one. NASDAQ Futures up one. So we're not doing much today. We have the ADP labor number that came out yesterday. Very low. Way less than expected. And we'll see if that is a precursor of tomorrow's number. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. We have Professor Liu.
Good morning, sir.
How are you, bud?
I'm doing well. I noted that the show went off. Actually, I sounded better in my absence last week, so...
I don't think so.
Well done. I'll try to make up for it today. I wanted to start by noting the passing of a guy that I knew personally quite well, Jim Marshall, who was a defensive end for the Minnesota Vikings back.
Oh, really?
In the,
Jim Marshall died well.
Yeah, back in the glory days, and you know, held the record for NFL games started at 270 as a defensive end. You know, back when playing careers tended to be a lot shorter, and he was a remarkable football player.
That group.
When you were around him, he was one of those guys that really sort of first kind of epitomized the happiness and joy, if you will, of playing football. He really enjoyed the game. I mean, he enjoyed the practices. I was never exposed to somebody who, you know, was happy going out to practice football, and that was Jim. So
allegedly, anyway. Merlin Olsen was like that as well.
I think so. I didn't know him. But Marshall was just, you know, one of those guys that just really enjoyed, you know, the physicality, the camaraderie, the team ethos. And when Bud Grant took the team over, and I remember my father talking about this, he identified Jim as one of the leaders, and really one of the guys you have to sort of get on your side so that you've got the locker room. And I think he sat down with him and just said, look, here's what I'm going to do, and it's going to sound stupid at first, and you guys can make fun of it if you want, but here's how we're going to run the program, and if you stay with me, we'll have results, and you'll see him.
What was so different about the change? What do you do differently?
Oh, well, Grant replaced Norm Van Brocklin, so
he was a former quarterback, right, somewhere?
Yeah, and a screamer, and a temper tantrum guy, and mercurial, and as one sports writer said, Grant coming in and taking that team was like having Ivan the Terrible being replaced by Calvin Coolidge. Bud was, you know, thoughtful and logical, and had plenty of emotion, but didn't really show it. And he immediately,
like a Tom Landry sort of dude.
Yeah, except except even more, probably even a better psychological, or one of those guys with psychological perception of who, you know, who you wanted to be in charge, and who was going to play for you well and who wasn't. And Bud sat Marshall down and said, "Look, this is going to look Mickey Mouse. I'm gonna make rules and I'm gonna enforce them. You haven't had that." Van Brocklin was all over the place. You know, Van Brocklin had team rules that sometimes he put into effect, sometimes he didn't.
What kind of rules are you talking about? Have you never been?
Oh well, so for example, your socks have to be always pulled up on your uniform. No smoking, except in rooms of a certain size. At one of my father's players came up and said, "John, I have to be a surveyor to know whether it's okay to smoke."
Back in those days, it was hard to tell people not to smoke. Now I can't imagine letting anybody smoke.
I can't imagine anybody. But you know, a lot of the players smoke cigarettes, and you know, Bud said, "We're not going to do this. It's, you know, you guys want to destroy your health, that's fine, but." We're not going to do this around the team facilities, and you're not going to be allowed to smoke in hotel rooms unless they're of a certain size, and where we can be, your smoke's not going to affect everybody else.
Didn't that guy, Krayuf, one of the world's greatest soccer players, didn't he die amazingly young, and he was a super chain smoker even when he played?
Yeah. So Bud had them preseason game, and I've told you this story on the air before. Bud had one of the guys, a tight end, and I've just dumped his name, John Beasley, who had just come back from Army National Guard training. So this is 1967, Vietnam's going full bore, and several of the players were National Guard players. So they had National Guard duty, and he had just come back from his 2-week or whatever it was stint of National Guard duty, and Bud had all the players said, last thing they did before they got on the bus to go to the to go back to Minneapolis to, you know, get ready to travel, he said, "We're going to practice standing at attention for the national anthem." And so he had Beasley instruct everybody how to stand at attention with helmets under the left arm and stand on the sideline, face the flag. They were the first NFL team that did that.
Was Bud, he coached in Canada forever. Was he from Canada or was he from Minnesota?
No, Minnesota. Okay. He's like a 3-sport letterman at the University of Minnesota, All-American in 2 of them. He was on the Minneapolis Lakers, pre-LA Lakers, NBA championship team, started for them, and he played...
Did he play with Wilt?
He's been too old for Wilt, probably. No, I think he's too old. He was there before Wilt played. He played for the Philadelphia Eagles. That's where he met my father.
He had to be a Johnny Kirk time guy.
I'm not sure who that
Johnny
is.
Johnny Kirk is a guy from... he played for the Syracuse Nationals. He was Illinois. Took Illinois to the NCAAs. He went to Tilden Tech here with my cousin. Johnny Kirk would be 93-ish, 94.
Bud's a little older.
Okay.
Or was a little older. He passed away last year.
It seemed like to me, just, you know, and I'm obviously not close to like you were, that the Minnesota had a pretty cerebral team. I mean, they had guys like Alan Page and a Supreme Court judge in Minnesota, and they had guys on the team that were, wasn't Marshall really pretty, who's the other guy?
Jim was very smart.
So I'm saying it seemed like it was not your normal football team in terms of intelligence.
I can't say that because the NFL... The NFL in the 60s and 70s was full of smarter players because they couldn't earn a living just playing football.
Well, Tarkenton ended up being some kind of big real estate mogul.
Yeah, Tarkenton, Francis was a business magnate down in Atlanta. And he was very smart.
Is he still with us, or is he dead?
No, he's still around.
Right.
And, of course, you know, all the quarterbacks then called their own plays. So you know, if you're going to play quarterback... Which you know leads to some thoughts about modern day quarterbacks in terms of their intelligence, and what it takes to play the game. But Francis was really smart and had he effectively was another coach on the field when things were being called, and the defensive guys were the same way. But there were a lot of smart guys. I mean, Jim Ryan, the quarterback for the Cardinals, was a PhD in aerospace engineering. You just had, because these guys were doing different things in the off season, they tended not to be the kind of you couldn't be the kind of unidirectional or uni-skilled.
Well, isn't that why you had 6 exhibition games? Because guys showed up at camp after like selling shoes or drugs in the off season or something.
Camp was designed to get you into shape to play football.
Yeah.
They were out of shape. A lot of them were out of shape when they arrived, when they arrived at camp. And so, they did calisthenics. They did a lot of running. They did, they did workouts, weight workouts during training camp. I mean, all the stuff that we envision now in modern football is a function of the incredible profitability of it. But in the 1960s, the NFL was not that profitable.
Well, I would, if I were to, again, I'm talking to the officer.
Just, by the way, before we wrap up with Jim, 270 straight games at defensive end. He played into his 40s.
I think. Oh yeah, I remember he was
a grandfather.
Wow.
Playing in the NFL at defensive end.
Well, we had this discussion over adult beverages today versus old days. And I said, if I were to make a stab, and I'll lob this one out at you, the first teams that probably could somewhat play with a team today, where I would guess were the old Steelers, and the reason why I say that is during that era, it was the first time that football became a full-time job.
Well, yeah.
Before that, it wasn't. There's no way that a full-time guy now, a guy in those days, no matter how good they might have been, it wasn't full time. They weren't.
Right. But you were relying on a lot more sort of natural ferocity and athletic talent back in the 60s and 70s. I would say the Viking teams of the 70s, the Steelers of the 70s, the Cowboys of the 70s, those top Super Bowl, the Dolphins, those top programs could probably play now. I mean, they'd be as good now as, assuming, again, not assuming any modern training methods or diet or anything else, just take those guys, they'd probably be mid to lower level NFL clubs right now. For one thing, the size differential is dramatic. I mean Jim played defensive end at, I think, 250, and Alan Page was a defensive tackle that I don't think Alan ever weighed more than 260 pounds as a defensive tackle.
If you walk down the street, I mean, I was a bigger guy, but me at 6'4", when I was in shape, 220, it was rare for me to see somebody walk down the street 2-3 inches taller than me and a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they went, when Dr. J takes me up to see the Minnesota football team, the college team, when Pete was a linebacker, he goes, "This is the first 300-pound average offensive line team like in history, not even pros."
Yeah.
And I look at him and I go, "John, is this a line or is this a team for a pie eating contest?" They were all big fatsos. Every one of them's normal weight would have been 235.
Right, but training and strength training, especially.
I mean, they all had big guts. They were huge.
Doesn't matter.
I know, because you're only in space.
Because you know what? Yeah. In the 5 to 7 yards that those guys have to control, they can cover ground almost as quickly as a running back. And it doesn't matter what they look like. You get hit by that much mass moving quickly. It doesn't matter whether it's all muscle or part fat.
It's almost crossed into sumo wrestling.
Yeah, that much mass hitting you at any kind of velocity is gonna make a difference. Now, my father, the offensive line coach, said, at some point I'm watching him draw up plays, and he said, "Look, big fat guys pushing on other big fat guys is not offensive line play. And so his guys were big, but they were very mobile. And he looked for and trained for guys that could pull, trap, fold block. If you watch, you know, modern offensive line play right now, it looks a lot like the stuff that he and some of the other innovative coaches were putting in the 60s at the point of attack. You know, I don't want unless I've got Superman on my offensive line, and he did have Superman, two guys that would qualify. He said, but unless I've got somebody outstanding like that on the line, I don't want a one-on-one kind of push. I want two-on-one or one-and-a-half-on-one, so that we're not, you know, we don't have to rely on, you know, just personal attribute versus personal attribute. And so his guys tended to be a little bit leaner.
One of my buddies, one of your guys, an attorney dude, played for Bo up at Michigan. You know, he's probably, I want to say, 3 years older than us, well, maybe you're older than me. And Bo was absolutely adamant. You know, guy, everybody had a run. So he said nobody on the team was allowed to be over like 225 or 230, except for Dan Dierdorf, who was just a big man. And he was Dierdorf was 240, 245 without an ounce of fat on him. He was just a big guy. And he was allowed to be over the weight. I remember at Notre Dame, a good friend of one of my clients, I didn't know him very well, I played basketball against him a couple times. Walt Podolsky was, he was a number one, not a number one pick, but a first round draft pick to Buffalo. And he was this big Polish guy, nicest guy.
I remember him.
He's 6'8". The dude was 265, Lou, and I'll bet his blue jeans were 34.
Yeah. Well, Doug Atkins.
Yeah, same kind of thing.
Who played with my father at Tennessee. Doug was 6'8", you know, 270. And Doug was a high jumper.
What would he be today? What would he play today? 330 or something?
I'm sorry?
What would he play today? 330, 325?
330, 3, yeah, he'd have been 70 pounds heavier easily.
Yeah.
But maybe not as mobile. But you know, again, think about what I just said.
Yeah.
Atkins was a high jumper in college.
A good one too, right?
A good one. Oh yeah. Oh no. I mean, he wasn't, you know, just some guy who just wandered in and, you know, fell over the bar. I think my father said he scissored, because that's how they jumped back then. And if you don't know what a scissor high jump is, look it up, because I can't really describe it to you except to say that it involves basically standing up and jumping, you know, jumping so high your waist goes over the bar. He scissored over 6 feet in college.
Wasn't a Wilt a high jumper too, or was he a broad? He was something. He was on track.
I don't know. But anyway, I mean,
yeah, that's.
And I go back to in terms of just what people look like versus what they're capable of doing for you. Ken Patera, who was the brother of the Seattle head coach, who also coached with my dad, Ken Patera was the U.S. heavyweight weightlifting champion and an Olympian, and he was like 6'6", you know, like 370.
Wow.
And looked like, you know, looked like the Michelin tire guy, and I remember looking at him and saying, you know, he doesn't look athletic. And my father said, he can take a basketball from a standing jump, not even have to run. He can just squat, drop down about a half bend on his knees, and stuff a basketball.
That's unreal.
From a standing jump.
Wasn't the guy who's his brother's still playing, one of the Watt brothers, but the older brother, couldn't he stand in the 3 foot end of the swimming pool and do a squat jump out of the thing or something?
Jump out of the water, yeah.
How can anybody do that?
Leg strength. I mean, it's just modern. It's just modern training. But anyway, I want to just hat tip to the
memory. Well, I just remember those guys as being a very cerebral sort of team. And I know when they ran against Kansas City, one of the issues they had was Mick Tinglehoff wasn't a very big guy, and Curly Culp lined over to center, and he was a monster, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he gave him fits. But you know, again, that Kansas City team was not dominant. That was the same. Minnesota took that team apart the next season in their opening game of the regular season. Same team, same guys, They beat them like a drum in Metropolitan Stadium. They had a really bad game, probably one of their worst games against Kansas City in that first Super Bowl.
The name Norm Van Brocklin, he was a big star in some college. Was he a Heisman Trophy guy?
He may have been, but he was an NFL champion with the Eagles.
Okay, but he was a big college star too, wasn't he, somewhere?
I'm sure he was. I don't know, but I can't pull his college career down off the top of my head.
Well, hey, years ago, Lou, I read the book, and I'll keep this short. I read the book and actually heard this guy talk. Remember the book Investment Biker? The goofball that went around the world on a motorcycle?
Vaguely.
He was the professor and took the grad student girl with him, much to her parents' chagrin. Anyway, he went all around the world on a motorcycle investigating. And a lot of the book was really interesting, like when he visited the Vienna stock market and all these places nobody even heard of. He bought stocks like all the way around the world. But anyway, when he was crossing Russia, he said he gets to some town on the motorcycles, and he goes, "I'm going to the next town." The guy's like, "You know, you're not on the motorcycles. There's no road." He goes, "What do you mean? The city's right over there." You're coming from America, there's always a road between two cities, right? And right. They said, if you want, you can like bribe the train guy when it stops, and they'll let you use a flat car, and you can put your motorcycles up there and pitch a little tent or something. So from several of the cities, they had to go by train. And so when I heard about this drone attack, and how somehow they got from Ukraine to the other end of Siberia, I'm thinking, how in God's name did they do that? I mean, Russia does not have an interstate highway of any kind. I mean, what are the logistics on this deal? I mean,
okay. So that was my next topic. Nice segue. So, based on what I haven't driven across Russia, but I've driven through parts of Russia, and not just the well-developed metropolitan areas. My guess is that there are roads that go through across the country. You can drive across the country. And so these major military installations would have road access, if not highway access. So the report that I read was that they hired trucks to pick up these prefab housing units, which is what they were delivering. So especially in some of the more remote areas, that makes perfect sense. You would be shipping prefab housing out there. They picked these up in Kazakhstan, which is even less developed than Russia, Tom.
Wow.
And I've driven across and through Kazakhstan. They picked these things up in Kazakhstan. They were assembled there, and then
how about bigger these things? You think
the drones or the trucks?
The drones first. Well, both actually.
The drones are about the size of a laptop computer in terms of space, and they don't have to carry, they don't have to carry a very big bomb to do what they were going to do.
But the wingspan's got to be 10 feet.
No, they can carry the drones that are running right now in Ukraine are about the size of a good sized laptop computer. They've got four or six little helicopter blades on them, and they'll carry 3-4 pounds of stuff.
Okay, because I know those are the, I'll use the term, recreational drones that people use to take pictures and stuff of houses at lottery hires, but I didn't know you could put any weight on those things.
You can, and I mean they're depending on what kind of system you're using. I mean, so supposedly they assembled all this in Kazakhstan and then drove the trucks. And these guys, the drivers, did not know what they were transporting. They were getting calls from people. They were getting calls from a quote some guy with a name that I begin with an A that I can't remember now. But they were getting calls from this guy saying, "Okay, here's the delivery point. Da 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 da. Here's your prepayment and take it here and." Leave the truck. And at some point the guys were told to leave the trucks or park the trucks, and there would be another truck coming to offload the shipping container. One of the trucks exploded on the side of the road. They've identified that because they had either the driver figured out something was going on or something else happened, but when they tried to deploy the drones, one of them detonated and set the rest of them off. The others got within range. Now, the really interesting thing from my perspective is how do you control them? Because they had video coming in from not just the drones that were carrying the explosives, they had video from drones that were watching them. So a portion of the drones that launched were bombers, kamikaze bombers, and a portion of the drones were observation, which is exactly what you would do. You know, that's you want proof that you've actually hit your target. And so how are they streaming the video back? There's some understanding that they were using the Russian cellular telephone network.
Wow.
And controlling them through cell towers, so that they could actually see in real time.
Well, that would make the Korean guy really pissed off, probably Putin as well.
Well, so the first thing that happened after this attack was the Russians set up checkpoints all throughout Russia and started stopping every big truck that they could get their hands on to look and see if they could find out if there were other ones still driving around. Obviously, you want to protect that. But I mean, I'm just trying to think about the kind of intelligence work that it took.
Well, said it took them a year.
But the kind of intelligence work it took to put people on the ground outside those bases to test whether you can get video from a drone sufficient detail that you can pilot the thing to photograph.
Well, how much power do these things take? What size is the battery pack?
Well, I mean, it's a good sized battery pack. I mean, they're not huge. I mean, they're the size of a couple of dinner plates.
See, you're amazingly educational here, because I've seen the ones Audrey gets, when she has a bigger house, she's going to put a presentation on, and she gets drones.
Right.
A guy with drones to come take pictures, and that thing is, like you say, it's about as big as a big pizza almost, and it has a bunch of little like helicopter blades, and off it goes, and it's got a little camera, and you control it. And I've seen pictures of ones like the Air Force has; they look like a small plane without a pilot.
Somehow I got the feeling these
were those, and they're not.
No, they're not. These are like quadricopters. These are like the ones Audrey uses.
But they, bigger. That thing could never carry.
Well, they're capable of carrying more. But you know, again, how much do you have to be able to carry?
Well, that I don't know. I mean, I would have guessed 10, 15 pounds. You're saying it's not that much.
No. You don't need that much with either a fragmentation charge. I mean, you can take out one of those airplanes with a hand grenade if you hit it in the right spot. And if you looked, and again, I have to take Zelensky at his word. If you look at the briefing that Zelensky was giving to somebody about the operation, they had marked on these models of these aircraft that they had practiced on, they had marked where they wanted the drone to hit, because that's where the fuel tanks were. And so, you know, a 3 or 4 pound explosive charge, even like, especially when it's like a shaped penetrator that, you know, hits the side of an aircraft near a fuel tank, is going to punch right through the side of the airplane, right into the fuel tank and ignite it.
But it has to explode when it hits. The thing's not heavy enough or fast enough to go through, but it's not like it. You know, it has to explode when it hits, right?
Right. Yeah. The drone itself doesn't have enough mass to do any damage. I mean, it might chip some paint off or something. But again, a 3 or 4 pound explosive charge on there with a fragmenting warhead will punch through stuff. And of course, they would have tested that. They would have photographed terrain features, buildings, etc. Because I assume that the initial launch of those drones was done by an AI program. So the drone takes off and it's programmed to recognize certain features to orient itself. It flies itself within range of the aircraft on its own, and then you know, the video signal provides the operator with the final guidance.
How far away do you think the launch truck could be from where the planes are? Is it a mile, 2 miles?
Oh, a mile or two, you know. Couple of kilometers.
So the observation, the direction drones, just ran out of gas and hit the ground. The Russians got those, right?
Yeah. Now,
do they blow themselves up? I guess is the question.
Well, I mean, either way. So here's another option. So they could have been using the cellular telephone network. Alternatively, the Ukrainians could have smuggled people in cars, that were these little remote controlled drone controllers that would then provide line of sight. As long as they had line of sight to the drone, they could control it, and they flew them in, and then they drove away.
Well, I don't know if I'd like that job.
Well, yeah, that's incredibly dangerous, obviously,
yeah.
Because you've got your agents on the ground, highly skilled people on the ground, and you got to get them out of there after the attack. So that's a simpler control scenario, but much more dangerous from a personal perspective.
When you drove, or, I mean, I don't know when the last time you did it. I mean, none of my business.
It's been two and a half decades almost.
But I mean, when you drove around Russia, now you do speak the language. So that's a plus, but just in general, you pull over for a gas or a cup of coffee, assuming they have coffee. What's the reaction to Americano?
Oh, they were astounded that I was wandering around. Second of all, that my Russian was good enough for them to understand me. And so, you know, I mean, I would love to tell you that I'm you know, as fluent as any spy, or as fluent as that guy in The Winds of War, but I wasn't. I mean, I spoke with a definite American accent. They would pick that up right away.
Well, I'm going to say something really dumb here. If you know the king's Russian, and you start wandering around the country, aren't there like a gazillion dialects or something?
Russia has a lot of dialects and a lot of idioms, and I mean, generally, my experience with native speakers when I was over there was that as soon as they figured out that I could passably speak, they immediately would go into a very fast, you know, chatter talk, and I would have to tell them always to slow down. And my Russian was pretty, you know, straightforward.
It's like people who speak Spanish.
Yeah.
People who know they speak it, and they talk to somebody in Spanish, and the guy's like eight sentences ahead of them.
Right. So slow down. Let me. Listen to what you're saying, because I need to pick the words out. But the this operation by Ukraine, two things. Number one, the argument that this is somehow a horrific escalation, that, you know, is going to provoke Russia to do some terrible stuff, that it was an attack on their strategic assets, I think is just simply wrong. These aircraft are used for strategic purposes. They carry nuclear weapons, but they've been shooting missiles at Ukraine. So you cannot assume that those aircraft are not legitimate targets, and the Ukrainians attacking them is radically different than if, for example, the Ukrainians were to disable a bunch of ICBM silos, which, you know,
I'm not so sure that wouldn't be. It's always funny that the winners seem to think they can make the rules, eh?
Well, theoretically, you could do that. But an attack by Ukraine on Russian ICBM silos or Russian missile submarine facilities would be seen as an escalation, that and a real provocation. But this is we're attacking aircraft that are attacking us, and they're fair game wherever they are. Okay, so I don't think it's an escalation. I don't think the Russians would view it that way. Now,
it's an insult to Putin. It's an escalation.
It's an insult to Putin. It's a slap in the face. But from an actual strategic impact on this conflict, I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference.
Is it like a Doolittle raid?
Pardon me?
It's sort of like the Doolittle raid?
Yeah, that's actually an excellent analogy. It's a Doolittle raid. Now, it's a lot more costly than a Doolittle raid, because the Russians aren't making those airplanes anymore, but and they're irreplaceable. But in terms of the, you know, it's not going to slow down what's happening on the border between Russia and Ukraine and the war right now. That is going to progress.
What is that status? You know, it's nowhere near page one anymore.
The Russians are grinding down the Ukrainian front like we thought they were, and they're getting smarter about doing it. They're still using a certain sense, the kind of meat grinder tactics we saw earlier, but they are basically exhausting the Ukrainian defenses and Ukrainian personnel, and then they occupy that area. They throw people in there. They're launching something between 2 and 3 million more drone attacks per year than the Ukrainians are, because the Russians can buy more and can produce more, and they've adopted this.
I thought
kind
the Ukrainians were able to outflank them and have a couple of strategic wins that kind of slowed it all down, but it just slowed it, right?
No, I mean it's now we're in static warfare, and it would take something akin to the left hook move that we performed in Iraq to break this up. And by left hook, I mean they would have to invade Belarus, swing through Belarus, and get around behind the almost fixed fortifications that the Russians have put in place along the border. That's why that offensive, what was it, 2 years ago, fell apart, because they tried to attack straight into the teeth of well-prepared Russian fortifications, and it didn't work.
You can't do that.
You know, and it's even harder now, Tom, because of the ubiquity of the drones that can disable, you know, if they can find you, they can disable
that
you.
That didn't work at Gettysburg either.
No. So the only way that this is going to become a war of maneuver is with either a massive injection of personnel and equipment across into one of these prepared defensive lines and breaking it, or swinging around behind it like the Germans did with the Maginot Line, swinging around behind it through Belarus, and, you know, that's or across the Black Sea.
Or something happens to Putin and somebody else gets in and says this isn't worth it. That's kind of what happened in Afghanistan, right?
A little bit, but I don't see that happening.
Six months ago, you sent me all the stuff on Russian trains and all the stuff that was breaking down in Russia, spare parts, ammunition. Yep. That can't be getting any better. I mean, it's your opinion, though, I mean, obviously the schooled one, that Ukraine is slipping faster than Russia, but Russia has to be slipping as well.
Yeah, and so the question, you know, this was, I think I said at the beginning of the year, according to a number of analysts that I've read, this was going to be the year where Russia was either going to run out of people, run out of equipment, or a combination of both, if they kept going. The numbers, the casualty figures that you're seeing coming out on Russian forces are unbelievable. Ukraine's are a little bit better in terms of percentages of the population, but Russia has, by various estimates, lost somewhere between 300,000 and maybe 500,000 killed. I mean, that's a huge range, but that's what we're dealing
number,
with.
A huge number, either end of the range.
Yeah, and you know, maybe three times that many wounded, and so it's a.
I can't even imagine what their hospitalization system is and their VA system.
And this probably is none. This isn't changing. The Ukrainians have been able to exact a terrible price for every kilometer of ground the Russians gain, but the Russians are gaining it, and
what are they doing with all the bodies, for God's sake? What's the logistics of this? It's like Civil War, we just pile them all up, or what?
Well, a lot of the bodies they leave, you know, in the field. The Russian ethic, and it may be getting better now, but the Russian ethic, at least at the start of the war and throughout the course of most of it, was that the individual soldier was just totally expendable.
What is the ratten population? Oh God, I can't even
imagine putting people into your front lines and ordering them forward on crutches, because that's what they're doing. And it's crazy. I mean, it's conditions that we would never tolerate. But they're pushing through it, and telling their people to do it.
And I understand they don't have any political power, like maybe we think we do. I don't know if we do or not, but. But somebody in, I don't know how many people are in Siberia, they got to wonder why the hell I need Ukraine and why my kids got to die over there, or my husband, or both. I mean,
they don't have the same view on that as we do. And the traditional Russian support for this war, and there's a lot of it, is that if our kids have to do this, then so be it, because this is us against the West. And we have to put this down now and regain this now before we have a country of, let me get the adjectives right, Nazi drug dealing homosexuals on our border.
Well, they got a point there. They got a point there. I mean, I'm not so sure they're totally mistaken there, but I mean, I don't think Russian mothers aren't as fond of their kids as American mothers.
They look at sacrificing them differently. The concept of the Rodina, the motherland, is very strong there. Much stronger than it is here. And so you are not seeing, and probably won't, you're not seeing a popular uprising against this war. And that's been true from day one. And that's a hard thing for us to understand.
But they don't have any, I mean, nobody's pissed off?
Probably some oligarchs are upset that they're not making as much money. But you're not seeing any kind of popular, I mean, there is some dissent in Russia. But you're not seeing any kind of major dissent that's going to cause Putin to turn around and say, yeah, maybe I ought to rethink this. There hasn't been any indication of that there.
Well, but he must, his support among the people, even though the rest of the people might still have that point of view, the guys around him have gotten a taste. They can't be happy to lose their yacht and lose everything else.
Again, the focus for these guys is to stay in power, and it's not to act in for the benefit, quote unquote, of the Russian people. The Russian people are expendable. You know, the thing that has to survive is Russia. Now, at some point, you should be saying to yourself, "Well, wait a minute. If you don't have the people, then you don't have the country." But the leadership doesn't quite look at it that way.
I'm
convinced that Putin and his people absolutely believe in the rightness of their cause. They absolutely believe that they are the spiritual salvation of the world. Think about that for a second.
They have no spiritual.
Well, yes, they do. What is being spun to the Russian people is this narrative that you know, the only true church was Kiev. It was the only one that wasn't conquered by the Ottomans or taken over by homosexual Nazi drug dealers. And so this is the Russian Orthodox Church is the center of spirituality and moral rightness in the world. And so we are fighting against the depravity of not only Ukraine, but the West. And so just to give you a picture, the gay pride parade that I'm sure will go through downtown Chicago or here,
actually goes
through
Boys Town, but it's up north. Doesn't make it downtown.
Okay, well, with whatever pictures of, you know, depravity that, you know, come out of that, to the extent that they do, this will be broadcast in Russian saying this is what we're fighting against. You know, if you want your kids to grow up like this, then you know, go move to the West, because this is what the West is like.
Lou, we've had some, I'm going to change the subject saying a little bit, because we've had some discussions lately, actually for a long time now, about things that seem to have changed in our lifetime, and that maybe, I don't know if they're huge things, or they've all been sort of gradual or not gradual, if there is a theme to the show, is that everything kind of depends on everything else. I mean, I've always had that feel of life in the world, and we've been talking about just changes that we've seen. I mean, Carl was bringing up one of his buddies that evidently he worked pretty hard for, and I think he might have even been the finance guy for the campaign to make sure nothing was untoward there, because if they don't like you, they come after you, evidently. And the dude got elected for, I'm thinking, one or two terms. We've had a discussion with him a couple times. Now, when he went to the House, he's on the Republican side, they go for their little orientation, and they told him that if you have a phone, you have to not use it. You have to use, like, our phone, whoever the ours guys are. And Carl was going to put a wall, where people can't get into your system.
Firewall,
you know, because, you know, this is what Carl's really good at. He said, I'll set your office up for you. And they go, that ain't happening, whoever they are. They almost essentially reserved the right to see what the guy was doing. And the guy got so freaked out, I think he did like one term or two. And then the thing was, you can do whatever you want, but if you don't do what we tell you, you're never going to get a committee assignment. Now, this is the Republican side. I'm assuming maybe the Democratic side is the same. Now, the question is, who tells the guy that you and I elect from our district how the hell he's supposed to behave if he wants to be equal to, like, the other guys? It's sort of like question one, because there's three things here. And the other one is we talk about the inflation and CPI all the time. And, you know, I say this all the time. When I was at Pullman, I did all that work for MBTA and in Amtrak. And when I say that, the inflation stuff, because everything had escalation clauses. And Lou, there was never really a feeling at all if the CPI number 1 month was 1% inflation, which by the way it was, because it was like 12%. I mean, I'd call up Boston and I'd say, hey, our contract that was $60 million is now, $60,600,000, and they go, okay. There wasn't even a hint that as bad as the inflation situation was, that the government was lying about it. Now, we weren't going to complain about was it 0.9 or 1.1. There was a general feeling that the numbers were legit. And now in the last few weeks, again, this is, to you it's going to seem like I'm changing the subject, but to me I'm not. Audrey's had, we had a funeral to go to, way the hell out in Marengo, and we had a wedding somewhere else. Anyway, I've been hauling ass on the expressways here. 100 miles an hour, 95 miles an hour, three or four guys drag racing. Lou, I once in a great while do I see a policeman. It doesn't matter if it's Dan Ryan or it's a Northwest Expressway. It doesn't matter if people are white or black or Hispanic. This isn't something that's once in a while. Somebody somewhere has made the call, guess what? We're not going to traffic police anymore. If there's an accident, then we send five guys out there to sit around while we decide what happened. I mean, I want to know who's making these decisions. Who's the man behind the curtain? I mean, who's telling the freshman congressman, if you don't play our way, you don't belong here, and by the way, you can sit here and twiddle your thumbs for 2 years and you're not getting a committee assignment, and oh, by the way, we'd still like your vote. Who's telling the policeman not to go into traffic? Who's telling somebody lie on the CPI? Who's the somebody? Politically to me, I went back to the last 32 years, which you probably know off the top of your head. We've had 16 years Republican, 16 years of Democrat. It never changes. Whatever is going on, if it's big money behind people, whether it's people now in the news, I don't know what it is, Lou, but it seems like somebody's making decisions that I can't believe people are making. And who the hell are they?
So I'm not sure about the congressman's story. I can certainly understand being told we're not going to allow you to put third party applications or whatever on your systems because we don't know what those are, and for all we know, your buddy's a Chinese communist spy. And
I mean, would you think you had to surrender your cell phone and use theirs?
I would for official business. Yeah, I sure would.
I think it's all business, but anyway, it's what Carl was.
Well, in any event, I don't know about that, and I don't. I mean, I can understand why you would do that in certain areas, but with respect to the who's making the decisions about the cops? Well, George Soros is making part of it. Because he personally went through and funded dozens of district attorney races in an effort to thwart, thwart law enforcement in a number of big cities, and Chicago's a number one example.
But these are state guys.
That's what I mean. Your state attorneys.
I don't buy the Soros is an evil guy. Somebody somewhere is.
I don't. I'm not ascribing any kind of moral issue to him. You're asking who was putting people in charge or who's
he the same guy telling people to lie on the CPI?
A consistent app of failure of law enforcement across major cities in the United States is the direct result of George Soros funded district attorneys and Commonwealth attorneys who have decided we're not going to prosecute people of a certain race or color, or we're not going to prosecute certain crimes because they impact people of certain races. And if you want to look at, I can hold up examples here in Denver. I can hold up examples in San Francisco.
The people who were going 100 miles an hour in the Northwest were all white. So
I'm not saying what your observation is. I mean, if you want numbers, you can find any number of studies that find that minority drivers are worse.
But I'm saying.
Let me finish.
It's not last week,
because I'm talking about data. If you look at law enforcement statistics and you see law enforcement statistics, a consistent application of law against people of a certain race or certain minority because of certain offenses, then you say, okay, you know what? I'm not going to enforce those statutes. And that's what was happening. That's what was happening in Chicago. That's why you had those mass shoplifting runs down on the Miracle Mile. That's what was happening in San Francisco. That's why people were being told by the police in San Francisco to roll your windows down on your cars and leave them unlocked so that stuff can be stolen out of them without having the windows broken. I mean, this kind of thing is endemic.
I think it somehow or another, Lou, it goes deeper than that. It's personnel, it's laziness, it's people say they're doing other stuff. People are afraid that if they pull a white person over, they'll sue them. There's an excuse. I'm saying thing as a CP. I mean, I read this thing once that every single president since Kennedy, maybe including Kennedy, now there's been a lot of presidents since I read this article, has done some crappy thing to how you count the federal deficit that's changed the way. But Johnson pulled the Social Security used to be separate, so they would say the deficit was in the regular budget. They had a surplus of Social Security. Well, Johnson put them together, so it didn't look like we. Then Nixon did something else. Then Ford did something. Everybody did something to essentially lie to people. And now here we're at the game where I don't believe any of these numbers. I mean, how do you have a? I mean, this big beautiful bill. The administration says it's going to save $1.7 trillion over a certain number of years. Budget office says it's going to cost $2.4 trillion. Mm-hmm. And Trump's mouthpiece lady goes, well, nobody believes the government budget office. I'm going, wait a minute. No, aren't those the guys supposed to be doing this stuff? I'm getting this entire, I don't think it's healthy, Lou, for everybody to say that everybody doesn't agree with you is an idiot.
Tom, this is, yeah, I mean, and I've said this several times, Donald Trump's superpower is getting people at whatever level you want to think of to reveal themselves and reveal their true nature. And so what you're seeing is the true nature. You saw this in his first term, and you're seeing it to a certain extent now. His opponents are revealing themselves. And
so is he.
Well, but he doesn't care.
Yeah, well, that's, you know,
that's the big difference. And I think we joked about this one time where I said the idea that the back in the days when people thought, well, Trump's could be blackmailed by the Russians, and I'm thinking if ever there was a guy that's totally unashamed of anything he's ever done and is least likely to be blackmailed, it's the president. What you're seeing is the deep state, as it's referred to, revealing itself.
By the way, Newsmax, they say deep state every other word.
It revealed itself throughout COVID. It revealed itself with respect to the things that were done in the last administration to suppress free speech, to the extent now that most people look at anything coming out of a government agency, and Musk's people dug into this too. Anything coming out of a government agency is immediately suspect because somebody has an ulterior motive with respect to how that data came out. And I'll give you another example. And it's astounding to me, but the federal judiciary is falling into this category. And I'm
just because they don't like this dictator?
No, because they don't like him, and the fact that they don't like him is apparently driving their decisions versus like the law, which is supposed to be.
There is no law with this guy.
Yes, there is.
Where?
Oh yeah, there is. Now, you may not like the interpretation that they put on the law, but he is following, and his people are following the law. Who's not following the law in many cases are federal judges who are saying for example, let me give you a classic example. This entire immigration brouhaha with district court judges enjoining all kinds of immigration decisions are totally without basis in law. D- Do you know that? You want to talk about lawlessness? So the federal judge here last night enjoined the deportation of the family of that guy who tried to burn Jews alive in Boulder. They're all here apparently illegally. At least that's the allegation, and they're going to get deported. So he issues an order last night, quoting something called the All Writs Act, saying this gives me the authority to enjoin that.
I hope you wouldn't be the guy that he would call upon to say, I'm going to do this, find me a law that says I can, and you dig back to something 100 years from now and pull it out and say this one should work.
But he didn't. The trouble is that there is a specific statute passed by Congress that says that the federal district courts have no jurisdiction over these cases at all. And so this is, I mean, not just my opinion, in the opinion of a number of federal prosecutors, this is totally lawless. This judge issuing this TRO is totally lawless. There is no basis in law for this opinion.
It's kind of, I don't really want to dig into this,
stuff. You can find this throughout these immigration cases.
From what I understand, I'm not a fan of somebody winging fire at people, as you obviously know. I hope you know. The guy does this. Okay, it's murder. It's attempted murder. Did anybody die? I hope not. But did anybody die or just we?
I think two are in critical condition.
Well,
so.
That's bad enough. Okay, so close enough. These are state cases, right?
Yes.
Okay, so evidently.
Well, what do you mean state? What do you mean state cases?
I mean it's a murder case.
The assault is, yes, that's a state case. Although the feds can take jurisdiction, they can charge it as a civil rights violation.
Okay, so what I'm saying is that now, you name me, counselor. Any time that I've never done this, but if I punch somebody, if I kick somebody in the ass, or if I shot them or knifed them, how is that not a hate crime? I obviously don't love you because I wouldn't have kicked you in the ass or knifed you. So the idea that you can brand it a hate crime and sweep in with your federal Gestapo to me is pretty fucked up.
Well, first of all, you got separate sovereigns, separate crimes.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
But the concept of hate crime is problematic in my opinion, because we don't criminalize what people think. But there's a whole body of federal law passed by Congress, signed by Bill Clinton, I think, that says if you act in a certain way with certain motivation against certain groups. Like if you're burning crosses on people's yards, then that's a federal law violation, and they can federalize.
They have. I just want them to define to me what a love crime is. Before it's a hate crime.
Crime of passion. But I mean, yeah. Typically, there's plenty of state laws this guy violated. Okay, but he also violated federal law, and the feds are coming in because the state of Colorado has demonstrated repeatedly that it doesn't care about these kinds of, I say it doesn't care, it's really not that interested in prosecuting these cases. You had that kid who murdered 16 people at the King Supers up in Boulder, who was attacking them, because which was known as the Jewish King Supers, because it went out of its way to stock halal and kosher foods. He goes in there to shoot Jews specifically, and Colorado just made that case disappear. Now they prosecuted him, but it was done very low key. You know, they were walking around for weeks saying, we really don't know what motivated this guy. You know, you take a look at that and you say, this is a state that's not serious about dealing with anti-Semitism.
Anytime somebody does anything to anybody, you know, I'm the softest guy on earth. I don't want anybody messing with anybody. That's why I'd like law enforcement there, because that's what they're supposed to do, is protect people, right? But this, I look at this, any criticism I might have, or you might have, of Biden or Trump, and by the way, I think both of us have criticism of both. I probably have more of Biden than I do of Trump, actually. I don't consider myself an anti-American. I'm looking for things to get better. I mean, given what's happened in the Middle East, in the incredible amount of people that are dead in Palestine, I don't see why, if I'm anti-Netanyahu's, you know, kill the world policy, that makes me anti-Jewish. It doesn't at all. I'm absolutely think that Israel's probably our best ally, except for maybe the UK, and I want him to live on for hundreds and hundreds of years without people messing with him. That doesn't mean I like that guy. That doesn't make me anti-Semitic. And no, it doesn't make me a hate crime if I say it.
This guy wasn't making the distinguishing point. He was saying, "I'm going to kill all the Zionists, and I want to kill them, and I'll go kill them."
I'm not defending this dude at all, but somebody at a university who says, "Hey, you're killing too many people," I don't think that's necessarily anti-Semitic.
My point is, you were asking about how this gets federalized. It gets federalized because Colorado has not demonstrated that it really takes this stuff that seriously, and so the feds come in and say, "Okay, fine, you're going to let this kind of stuff fester."
But they didn't, and they didn't not arrest the guy.
No, he was here illegally. They gave him a driver's license. They you know, gave him work authorization. He was allowed to stay here, get his kid graduated from high school. He should have been gone. Colorado's a sanctuary state.
Well, how messed up?
They allow this to exist here, which is why the feds say, "Okay, you're not serious about this whole thing. We are. We're going to move on it."
Well, we got to dash pretty soon. Let me ask you this. It is stunning to me that once in a while I come across somebody, usually a Polish descent in Chicago or Hispanic, that have been here for 20, 30 years. They've maybe served in the Army. Their kids have served in the Army. They're still not a citizen. How the hell does that work?
I don't know. One way it works is that there has not been the kind of concerted immigration enforcement that you're seeing now under President Trump.
But they all want to be citizens.
Pardon me?
They all want to be citizens, every one of these persons I've talked to. Yeah. I've talked to people who are honorably discharged from the Army. I would have thought that a citizenry kind of went along with that, but evidently not. How can that be?
I don't know specifically that circumstance, but I do know that one of the things that's happening is, and it's direct result of this border meltdown that we had the last 4 years. One of the things that's happening right now is universal enforcement of this stuff, and I'm going to leave you with this. If the states would cooperate with ICE, who are now going after almost exclusively the really bad guys first, they would focus on getting the bad guys. Instead, what's happening is because they are not getting cooperation, they are sweeping with as broad a net as possible. And so they are dragnetting in a lot of people.
Who are they?
ICE.
I mean, is ICE, are they wearing special uniforms? I mean, who are they? I mean, how many people are in ICE?
They're federal immigration agents.
How many people of them are, how big is this force?
I don't know, but they are sweeping up everybody. And so this is going to get the just and the unjust. It's like the rain that falleth from heaven.
But everybody deserves a process, Lou, no matter who you are.
If you're here illegally, you get a process. It's minimal, but you get a process.
What's the process? Get on a plane? Last week they were talking about half a million people.
Show us that you are allowed to stay here. Your name's on a list. Show us that you're allowed to be here.
That's
legally.
Not a process, according to me.
You have to prove that you're here properly. You don't get a lawyer.
Okay, why not?
Because that's not part of what we've. That's not part of what we've aligned as due process for people who are here illegally. If you walk in the country illegally, you don't get the kind of rights with respect to your immigration status, not criminal status, but immigration status, that you do if you were a citizen.
These guys are talking about a half a million people. How exactly are we going to?
They're talking about 20 million.
Okay, how exactly are we going to push out 20 million people?
I don't know, but
we're not going to walk, are we? I mean, we're going to
start with the criminals.
How about we're going to take every cruise ship and load them up and send them someplace?
We're in the process of doing that. We're going to start with the criminals, and again, that's why the sanctuary states are actually working against the kind of selective enforcement that you're talking about. So, on that note, I got to run.
All right, but everybody, what's going on out there? You guys got decent weather? Is it dry, warm?
It's gorgeous.
Good
gorgeous.
For you.
So
what,
come
what,
on
what
out.
Is the, oh, what is the matter with your baseball team?
Oh, they're terrible. They're terrible. They've got an owner that doesn't... The owner doesn't care, I don't think.
Why don't you buy them?
Yeah. My checkbook's not really enough to handle a hot dog at that stadium.
Actually, I think they have
which is a gorgeous place to watch a baseball game.
I think they have the lowest beer prices in the league.
Yeah, they are. It's not exorbitant there, but it's you know they've got an attraction in downtown that they're making money. The owner, I don't think, really cares very much.
You know, I have a interesting. If you got 30 seconds, I've been going back and forth with all my modern people. You know, of course, I'm the Luddite, and I kind of been bitching and moaning about. People not getting actual tickets. And I watched the Cubs play in the Nationals, and when I was there a decade ago, the seats were packed, but a real lot of exceptional-looking young ladies, and those are all lobbyists and those kind of firm seats. And they obviously were giving the tickets to people, which is fine. I mean, that's the way you get tickets, right? Well, now there's nobody there. And I wonder if people don't want on their cell phones or on their computers a track record of them giving tickets to, you know, good-looking staffers or something. I mean, somewhere along the line, I think this not being able to give somebody a ticket. When I had season tickets and guys on the trading floor wanted to go, I just gave them a ticket. I didn't want to write their names down. I didn't want to tell their boss I gave them a $50 ticket. I mean, I think we somehow have gummed this up somewhat. By everything being going through the Major League Baseball, you got to go through them to transfer
tickets.
Yeah,
the MLB app. Yeah.
You know, I think that's really harming attendance. You think I'm totally nuts like everybody else thinks I am or what?
Maybe for old people like you and me, if the younger people don't think about it.
But I may say, if I don't want to give it to them, I don't, you know, if I see...
Well, yeah, for old guys like you and me, that matters. But
I don't, why do I want all these people...
Younger Americans don't mind doing that kind of digital swapping.
Okay, but if they're your tickets, you mind?
It may stop me from doing it, but again, you and I are only purchasing a small portion of the tickets.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but anyway, bud, have a good weekend. We'll talk at you next week. SP Futures up 3, NASDAQ Futures up 6. Real quick break. We'll come back with Mr. Wayne Manson.
Support the Stocks and Jocks team. Hats, t-shirts, sweatshirts, jackets, and Chief's favorite, the Stocks and Jocks ladies thong, all available at our online store. Just go to stocksandjocks.com and click the link to order any amount of great Stocks and Jocks merchandise for yourself and any other Stocks and Jocks listener in your life. The prices are affordable and the selection is out of the park. The Stocks and Jocks online store at stocksandjocks.com.
Stocks and Jocks. Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
We're back on.
Hello. Welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. S&P up 3. Futures up 7. Jimmy's working on things over there. He's not as smooth as he's going to be next week, I'll say. Do we have Mr. Wayne?
I am here.
How are you, bud?
I'm doing a solo today. My partner in crime is off to his alma mater for some sort of meeting up there at Cornell.
Hey, so, he turned it into some kind of a town hall and everything. He was telling me all about it.
Yeah. You know, Cornell was on the list of these universities that the Trump administration was going to try to shake down for whatever reason, so I guess there's a movement to at least there. I don't know if it's like Harvard, but there is a movement there to push back. So
Cornell's not Ivy League, are they?
They are considered Ivy League. Yes, okay.
Yeah. I'm not. Well, I'm not. I guess I never applied to the Ivy League.
You know, I never really understood the Ivy League because here you've got, you know, some universities are in there, and I don't know if it's based on you know, their law schools, the excellence in law schools, or what. But when you have these Ivy League schools, and then you see I know there's a very good law school at Duke in North Carolina, but they're not considered Ivy League. So
Ivy League's actually a league. I mean, it's a they all play football and basketball together. I mean,
right.
What is it? I mean, I don't think I can name. No, it's Harvard, Yale, Princeton. Is it Cornell? It's Brown, right? Is in there?
I think Brown's in there. University of Pennsylvania's in there.
They are, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Hey, we were talking again with Carl last week regarding I use the term. This is, I mean, I'm not as, well, I guess I'm interested in fixing stuff that's you know, you can fix, but I mean, our theme lately has been kind of a, you know, how this has changed over time. You know, when we're talking about every different subject world, how many squad cars are on the expressway 30 years ago since now for looking for speeders and other stuff. Seems like it keeps shrinking. Now, you know, Lou thinks it's all because, or a lot of it is because some people put district attorneys in charge and aren't going to prosecute anybody, or you feel that you're stopping one color versus another too many times, and somehow it's discriminatory, whatever. And we talked about the CPI that, to me, 40 years ago was eminently believable, and now is not, you know, at all. I mean, to the point where it's, to me, it's rampant lying. But Carl brought up an issue regarding a friend of his, and this is a while ago, I guess, where he helped the guy get in Congress, and how they wanted him to only use their cell phone, and basically he's a Republican. And how, you know, the first year guy is basically nothing. They said, if you don't do exactly what we tell you, you know, you're not even going to get a committee assignment. And I just wonder, I mean, most Americans don't realize that the person they just elected is like the, you know, it's like the redheaded stepkid in the corner. I mean, that somehow or another, if he doesn't stay 10 years and kiss somebody's mistletoe, that he doesn't get to do anything. Is this always been like that? I mean, back in the 1800s? Or is this... I get it, where with seniority, I mean, when I was on the SIBO board, hey, you know more your sixth year than you do your first year. I mean, I get that part. And you're closer to the process of what happened. You know the recent history better. But that didn't make me more powerful than the guy who just got elected. I mean, is this something new, or has it always been like that?
No, they all have an equal vote. But when it comes to... Even boils down to freshman members of Congress, more so in the House and the Senate. You know, what offices they get. There are some really crummy offices in the House, especially in the House office buildings. And I know I've been in some of them. A little bit of an exaggeration. But compared to other offices, they're like walk-in closets. And it all depends on, you know, how accessible they are to these offices are to the street. But yeah, it boils down to that type of favoritism, and also based on seniority. I knew a member of Congress who was in the House for 5 terms, so that's 10 years, and. Lost re-election because of being beat in a primary, but in the next election came back as a member of the House, and she lost all her previous seniority. But others who had a gap in their term in the Congress, it didn't happen to, and it all depends on what the House leadership thinks of you. And in what, you know, in many cases they say, oh yeah, we're going to recognize your seniority. But in the case of the person that I knew, who had been kind of a firebrand, didn't always go along with the leadership.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know,
from scratch.
I mean, part of this, you know, I try and understand people. I've been around a while, and I understand how some of this makes sense. I mean, if you're the number one guy or girl and one the first day on the agricultural committee, and the rest of the committee has been working on the bill for 4 years, and you're just starting out, I mean, it's going to be somewhat of a learning process before you can contribute, because you probably don't even know what the hell's going on. I mean, it's going to take you a while to... I mean, I get that part. I mean, I understand that there's, you know, there's a learning process and those kinds of things, to a point. But and it seems to me that, from what I've heard lately, it's the point might be a little too far, that the normal citizen might say, no, wait a minute, five people don't get to control this whole place just because they lived a long time. I mean, to me it seems like it's a little more extreme than just human emotion right now. Or am I?
No, it really is the case. I one example is a Democrat from Maryland, Steny Hoyer, who is in his, he's got to be in his mid to upper 80s now. Steny, when I was in the Navy in the early 80s, I lived very close to his congressional district. He was the congressman back then, you know, and I mean, this guy's been there forever. And when I see Steny Hoyer talking about something, you know, and he's making all these references that not even other members of his caucus know about, because some of them weren't even alive back in the early 80s. They weren't born yet. I shake my head. And it's as bad, and he's a Democrat, but it's as bad, it's just as bad over on the Republican side. They got one guy, I guess he's the longest in the House, this guy Hal Rogers from Kentucky, who used to be considered, he was involved in a lot of budget process. He used to be considered quite a moderate type Republican, but no, he's now going full MAGA, and you know, he's one of the rabble, and so, you know, sometimes you see these guys change their spots too, and it certainly is the case with him.
Well, I just it seems to me that it's a little bit, you know, kind of too much. What breaks people down? I mean, is there some semblance? I mean, you see, the Chicago area. I mean, there's guys that have been there like forever. Bobby Rush was there forever, and he just retired.
Yeah,
I don't think he's feeling too well, but I met him. He seemed like a nice enough guy. I don't know if he did anything when he was there, but then we have Danny Davis. Then we have like a Mike Quigley. Now Mike hasn't been there near as long.
Yeah,
but he managed to, he found his way onto the double secret committee and, you know, covert options for the Army and so forth. And that's a pretty select group. I mean, how do they decide? Just by how much work you put in, or how attentive you seem to be. I mean, who says, okay, well, we need 10 people for this committee? They got to be the top 10.
Yeah, if you've had some military time, that is weighed in as a factor. That might get you on the Armed Services or the Intelligence Committee, especially if when you were in the military, you were involved in intelligence. You know, there's actually a few ex-CIA people in Congress. Now, one person, Abigail Spanberger, she's a former CIA
really?
Officer, and she left the House. She's running for governor of Virginia this year. And it looks like it's a sure thing that she'll be elected. But other things, you know, they look at. They look at, well, where would this person fit better? Like AOC, she's a very good speaker. She's not bad on the eyes. Well, they put her in the government, the oversight committee, because that's where you can really, you know, shine if there's a hearing. And
I thought she was a Democrat. She's an independent, right?
No, she's a Democrat. AOC's a Democrat.
I just saw her speak the other day. She said she's an independent. Or she's independent maybe as a Democrat.
I think she means like she's no... Yeah, she can't be, you know, bossed around. Now, on the other hand, if you mess up or you come in there and the leadership doesn't really care for you, and say you're from a state like... New Mexico, And then they put you on the subcommittee for the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is nowhere near New Mexico. Yeah, no. That's sending you a message, too. This sort of thing has been going on forever. But the Democrats now have a lot of younger members. This Matthew Frost from down here in Florida, he's like, I think, one of the youngest guys that ever was elected to the House. And he's thought of well by the leadership, so he's probably going to be fast-tracked onto the more visible committees. Well, with a lot of responsibility.
The thing I'm sensing, Wayne, and boy, if it's true, and that's what I'm axing, if it's true, I actually think it's a pretty horrible development. I went to this it was before COVID. But one of my buddies drags me to one of those APEC meetings, right? So my buddy happens to be African American, right? So there's like, I was like the token goyim at that table, the token white guy. But it's a great group. So we had but these guys started talking, and for those people who don't know, the APEC is the American Israeli Political Action Committee.
Yes. American Israel Political
Action Committee. Yeah, but they're very, very serious lobbyists. And when I say serious, and I tell you what, I didn't really want to go, but I went because I'm a buddy of this guy. But I went, and I went twice. Wayne, I learned so much, I couldn't believe it. I mean, amazing how much you learn when you go someplace. First thing I learned was how hard it is to do lobbying. And these guys are all over everybody. And if you're a contributor, like if I would have, ponied up 10 grand or something, not only would I be a contributor, I'd get to go to their national meeting. And if I went to the national meeting, they would give me a 10 grand, probably the name of four or five representatives that I was supposed to go see and talk to them about APEC. Now, if I gave them 50 grand, I think the names would have been senators. Depending how much you gave. Now, you were free to, if I happened to be selling stuff to the government, I guess I could have mentioned it at one of those meetings. I know there was never anything, but I don't. I mean, for me, even if I wanted to, if I was all into this thing, but they were talking about how dumb the population is because they keep talking about everybody in Congress is there forever. And he goes, the guy said, that's the biggest crack of BS. He goes, we've had more turnover in the first two or three terms than like we've ever had. Because what these guys do, as soon as you get there, they, I think, offer you a trip to Israel.
Oh, absolutely.
And the guy says, because there's one district here in Illinois, the last five elections have had people change. And he goes, the turnover is dramatic in the first, this is a while ago. So it's totally different than what you hear in the press where, Nancy Pelosi's there for 100 years, so is everybody. But the thing I'm starting to figure out, though, or suspicious of, Wayne, is you're there for a term. You're there for a second term. If it gets to be three or so, and you don't cross the Rubicon, the river in Italy, and all of a sudden start taking money from the people you're supposed to take money from, you decide this isn't worth it and you quit. Or once you jump over, you almost jump into the right people own me kind of group. I won't say own, it's maybe too strong, but all of a sudden I'm in with the in crowd, which it almost means like you got to take a bribe just so they let you in the room because they're all taken by me.
You're absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, back in 2004, I was toying with running for Congress for the 8th District of Virginia, which is actually just across the Potomac River from D.C. The Democrat in Congress then had all kinds of problems. Jim Moran, he had, I think some of it had to do with maybe drinking, so I was approached by actually some moderate Republicans who said, look, we can never get a Republican elected in this district. We'll support you if you just go after, try to take down Moran and replace him. You'll be a Democrat, but we would rather have you representing us than him. So this got to the point where I met a campaign bundler, they're called. They bundle money from various donors. And he was very honest with me. He said, look, Moran is in trouble now because of his perceived lack of support for Israel. He gave a speech to a group in his district and said, look, the only reason we're in the Iraq war is because of two things, oil and Israel. Kaboom.
I don't think he was wrong.
No, this is the funny thing. They stripped him of his seniority. Been there for, he even had a chairmanship of some subcommittee. Stripped him of all that. And so I'm talking to this bundler, and he says, look, I can get you. He said, Moran has a huge war chest he's built up of money. He said, but I can get you $250,000 immediately from people who just are upset with what he said about Israel. This was, my bundler was not AIPAC, but he was talking about them, right? This is where that initial money was going to, it was like, oh, here, I'll spot you $10. That's the way, he says, look, and he said, do you have any Jewish family members? I said, yeah, my sister, she's Jewish, my brother-in-law. We're going to get them down. We're going to get them to talk to various groups, and you know how supportive I am of Israel. And I said to this bundler, Carl, I said, Carl, you know what? I disagree with Moran on a lot of things, but I happen to agree with him on what he said that got him in trouble. He said, yeah, but you can't say anything like that.
Well, that's the thing. You can't say it, but I don't necessarily think it's wrong. That's why the oil part I disagree with, but I mean, the fact that it would help Israel, I don't think that's a bad thing, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I think Moran threw in that we want a, you know, military bases over there. But anyway, yeah, I decided that I didn't really want to go through with this thing, especially when you have to submit basically you got to submit a package to the House Ethics Committee, even if you're a candidate, listing all your financial stuff, and they, you know, I'm looking at this stuff, they go back like 10 years, you know, what kind of cash gifts did you receive? I mean, I you know,
how can they be so? How can they be so?
You could go to prison if you make a false.
How do they scrutinize everybody so closely and end up with people that are crooks? Anyway, SP Futures down. We got to go to break here real quick. SP Futures down 4. NASDAQ Futures down 24. Just ducked here. We'll see what the initial jobless claims. That's tomorrow. What are we doing here? Anyway, we'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Well, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. This can be one of the toughest investment climates that I have ever seen. It's very difficult for someone to decide between risk-free investments like treasuries or CDs, corporate bonds at all-time low rates, or the stock market, which right now is somewhat unloved. On the other hand, if you have wealth, you are an investor and should be concerned about income and risk. Like everyone knows by now, the PTI Securities has a 14-year investment program called the Protect Index Program that has served our clients well for a long time. I think, however, that people associate that program with new cash investing, and that is somewhat true. What you may not know is that PTI also uses the same concepts and risk parameters to help clients with individual stock positions, especially a concentrated stock position. How many of you have your stock sitting in a brokerage firm where, if you ever felt the need for protection or income enhancement strategies, there'd be no one with a clue on how to help you? Are you really comfortable with those large concentrated stock positions? Ever think of talking about ways to possibly adjust the risk or income potential? It can only happen if that stock is in an account with a firm like PTI. And again, I can't think of a firm like PTI, with the Chief and others averaging 15 years of floor trading. Give us a call or contact PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Good morning.
Give us a call about your stock. 888-76-JACKS. That's 888-765-6257. Or email us stocksandjacks@live.com.
Good morning. It is 7:30 here on Thursday. The weather in Chicago, it is now about 57 degrees, and the high about 84, and the low tonight is 76. Phoenix, it is 83 and a high of 99 and a low of 76. Traffic, inbound Kennedy 29 minutes, inbound Edens from Lake Cook 46, inbound from the high Eisenhower to Wolf 37, And inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is 24. Inbound Stevenson from 294 is 45 minutes. Sports. Cubs lost. Sox lost. Diamondbacks went over one over the Braves 2-1. And in Stanley Cup, that was game one. The Oilers over the Panthers 3-4 in overtime. Now back to the Chief.
We have European Central Bank cut their rate down to 2% here. So we've got S&P futures down 2, NASDAQ futures down 18. That's not all that surprising, since yesterday and the day before I was reporting about how their money supply is, the growth has gone from 3% year over year to the last couple months 3.8. So they're pouring money into the system again over there, and so are we. You know, it's a I think it's an issue. The rest of the people think maybe it's cool, but I think in the long run it's going to cause inflation to come flying back. But that would be me. Dow futures are up 30. Like I say, NASDAQ futures down 9, S&P futures down 1. So not much going on there. Over in Europe, DAX up 103.4%, FTSE up 16.2%, CAC around up 21.3%, so generally bullish. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 192.5%, so a little bit down. Hang Seng up 252, that's 1%. Shanghai up 7, that's 0.2%. South Korea stocks extend post-election gains, hover at 10-month highs among mixed Asia markets. There's the headline. Bonds, we're sneaking down here. The U.S., the 10-year is down to 4.32 after being over 4.5. So a lot of this talk of interest rates coming down, I think we might be at the point that if short-term rates come down, you might see long-term rates actually go up over a period of time, but we'll see about that. Oil, up 32 cents, 63.17, kind of a high in the recently, but still the low 60s. Brent up 34 cents, 65.20. Natural gas unchanged, 270. Gold on a run again, up 19 bucks, 34.18. Silver up $1.34. That's almost 4% of the silver. It's a huge move in silver, 35.99. Copper up 11 cents over 5 hours. Over 5 hours for really the first time in a while. FX, dollar's down a little bit. We've got the pound over euro, 114.4. That's been as high as it's been for a while. The pound almost 136, 135.9. Crypto, Bitcoin's up 390, 105.429. I was going to say, what do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports? But we already did that. So back to Wayne. Yeah, Wayne, I don't, when you see, when people have this dim view of Congress, and you sort of see Congress, I mean, just about everybody, left and right on the show, agree that somehow Congress is, either through inaction or whatever, has caused the presidency to think they have more power, act like they have more power, actually have more power, somewhere in there. What if anything, is there, if what I'm thinking is true, that only a few people that actually are taking money from the right people are running the place, what's the fix there? What's going to cause Congress to say one day, no, you're not doing tariffs, we're doing them? I mean, if you want to do a tariff, you got to run them through. I mean, I don't see anything on the horizon that says they're going to put their big boy pants on and take some of this power back, do you?
Well, there's one thing in it. Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut, one Republican, one Democrat, they apparently got over 80 co-sponsors on a Senate bill to increase sanctions on Russia for what's going on in Ukraine. And apparently Trump talked to Putin yesterday for like an hour, hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes or so, and so it looked like the Senate was going to pass this bill. Now, if you've got at least 81 co-sponsors, you also have a veto-proof majority, because you've got way more than the two-thirds needed to override a presidential veto. Trump came back and said, look, can you hold off on voting for this? He seems to think that Ukraine was in the wrong for that, what I consider probably one of the most fantastic military operations I have seen. I would say that it's the most fantastic operation since Jimmy Doolittle's raid on Japan, which was a few months after Pearl Harbor.
We were talking about that with Lou.
Yeah, they were. You know, they used bombers that were taking off from aircraft carriers, which hadn't ever been done before. But anyway, so let's see if the Senate has any spine on this and says, look, Trump's just trying to kick the can down the road, and let's see if they do what they say they want to do.
Well, when Trump came in office, I mean, the whole during the campaign was you know, his great style is, you know, Biden's a blithering idiot. Anybody can solve this thing in 2 days, in 24 hours. Was it even an idiot could solve it in a week? Well, here we are, 6 months. And it's obviously much more complicated than was led on to believe. By the way, did his people actually believe that stuff when he says something like that? Yeah, they must. But now he's finding out that it's a pretty tough situation, and which I think a lot of people already knew. I mean, Lou was talking about the Russians don't think like we do. They'll do a lot for Mother Russia. They think we're all a bunch of gay gambler and drug smokers over here, and they don't want to be like us, and they don't have the same mindset that if they lose a son, I think people still like their kids, but Lou says it's not the same as here. It's a sacrifice you have to do if it's Mother Russia, and Lou's been there. I haven't, so I'm going to certainly tip my hat to him on this one. But he estimates 300,000 to 500,000 people killed from Russia in there, and an awful lot more wounded. First of all, I wonder what the sanctions would be, and secondly, what in your mind, what is going to shake this loose? I mean, I don't see, unless Putin has a grabber tonight and he gets somebody new in there, where is the solution here? From what I understand, the what these guys did is they went all around, and Lou says they were in trucks. They got them close to the place, and they were drones, and they went after essentially the planes, that bomber-type planes that could launch missiles into Ukraine, which they have been doing. So, in his mind, there's no problem with this being a war event. It's not like you bombed the Kremlin or something. I mean, he thinks that under any kind of rules of war, which I know are pretty slippery, there's no way you can count this as not a wartime act, that the Russians would think it was unfair. And that doesn't mean they're not going to say it's unfair. I mean, whatever. But do you have any idea what the sanctions were? Did they specify them out? Or?
Yeah, I think they were going to start freezing more Russian assets and possibly make it easier for some of those assets to be liquefied and turned over to Ukraine for defense and reconstruction purposes. But you know, these bombers, these strategic bombers, and here's, you know, talking about data from the government right now, from the federal government, that the U.S. intelligence community is now saying, oh no, the Ukrainians didn't take out that many aircraft. They took out half of what Ukraine claims, but Ukraine is using French surveillance satellites to come up with their bomb damage assessments. So somebody's lying here, and it's Tulsi Gabbard, who's she's the Kremlin mole. She's our director of national intelligence. She's totally pro Russia. So now we have a situation where U.S. intelligence cannot be believed, and if what Ukraine is saying is correct, a third of the Russian strategic bomber force was wiped out. Now, these planes include the Tu-95 Bear, which is sort of the Russian version of our B-52, only it's turboprops. But when I was in the Navy, we used to track Tu-95 Bears coming down the East Coast because they were all nuclear weapons capable. And they carry cruise missiles and they, you know, nuclear weapons. But all these bombers that were hit by the Ukrainians were a Soviet manufacturer And they don't have those assembly lines anymore, so they can't be replaced.
That's exactly what Lou said. He said the real damage is they're not making them anymore.
Yeah,
they're just gone.
Yeah, and also, what they hid them in was these sort of modular cabins that Russians like to use when they go hunting. You know, it's like a hunting cabin, but they're modular. They look like a small sort of container, with a door on the back. And so they had two of these per truck that were being dispersed around Russia as far away as
they weren't enclosed in the truck.
They weren't enclosed.
Well, if you ever drive through Indiana where they make all these trailers and modular homes and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
They're hanging on the back of the truck and hanging over both sides.
So the masterful thing about it is if you saw these being sitting on the side of the road out in Irkutsk in Siberia or up in Murmansk in the Russian Arctic near the Finnish border, you would say, oh, that somebody's going to buy them as a hunting cabin, or something, or a summer cabin. You wouldn't think. So they leave them there, and then they remotely control open the roofs from Ukraine, and then these drones take off, and they weren't even being piloted by humans. They were being piloted by AI. Which is another issue, and they train these drones on the same Soviet planes that are sitting at an air museum in Ukraine that tourists come to see. Oh, here's the planes we used to have when we were part of the Soviet Union, and that's how they trained them, trained the AI.
Well, Lou said they used the Russian cell network.
Yeah, that too, and So I'm thinking back when I was in the Navy, working in Navy intelligence during the Cold War. If we got word that, a third of the Soviet strategic bomber force had been wiped out, I mean, there'd be champagne corks popping all over the place. So it wasn't only Ukraine. I mean, these bombers would be used against us in a war, too.
Oh, yeah, I think it's pretty darn. Well, it took them a year. Wow, how do you keep something quiet for a year?
And no leaks. And that apparently Trump is now upset that they never told him. You tell Trump it's going to be. It's going to be a Putin's desk. And now there is a report. Remember when Joe Biden took the train into Ukraine?
Yeah.
He only had his national security advisor with him, a few Secret Service agents. That's it. There is a report that Zelensky did indicate to Biden that they were working on this plan. So one guy can keep a secret, and certainly the other guy could be trusted too.
Well, that's what do you make of we just lowered the interest rates in Europe. I don't know if you're on the economic front, but as we're talking conspiracy stuff today. I went through, I'll be very brief because I've done it 2 days in a row. I look at monetary stock, and I look at, the people who win and the people who lose when money goes into the system. And money has to go into the system because as the economy grows. If you grow 2%, you want your money supply to grow like 2%, maybe a hair more, so that you don't deflate, you actually maintain prices, and you don't really I guess if you could find a way to have a 0.5% of inflation every year. If you could ever, it's like saying you want to, when you get to be 20, you want to gain 0.5 pound a year, not 10 pounds a year or something. But I was looking this at, Wayne, I know you know something about this, if not a lot, but we've gone from, we've been averaging about 5.1, 5.2 year over year now for a while, and which is kind of high. But now the last month, and that's one thing I can't stand about Biden is he said don't put out weekly money supply numbers. The last month, which would be April that I know about, we all of a sudden shot to an 8.1% annual rate, which is really high because I don't think we're growing at all. The euro, same time, year over year, 3%. February, April, they're up to 3.8%. UK, 2.6 year over year. Last few months, 3.9. India, 9.4, now they're 28.8, which is even more bizarre. And this one, I think you'll find interesting. Japan, which it was 0.08 year over year in the last couple of months, is now 2.4. So First question is, if this keeps going like this, we're talking about massive inflation again. And we're talking probably 7-8% long-term rates within a year, a year and a half. I mean, if they keep doing it. I'm not saying they will keep doing it. But my question to you is, who makes this call that all of a sudden every country that means anything that I can find does the same thing at the same time? Is this, you know, Powell and the guard, you know, meeting and a couple of these people meeting on a battleship somewhere, even though we don't have battleships anymore? Is it is there a man behind the curtain? It's way too orchestrated for somebody to not know, or does somebody notice that we're doing it and they go ahead and do it? Or if you had a guess, it seems pretty organized, and I don't think it's Trump. I don't think it's Biden. I don't think it's a senator. Who's doing this? This is big worldwide news.
Yeah, I don't know about the procedure, but I do know one thing. I used to have a friend who covered the Federal Reserve, and sometimes he'd give me a ride home. We'd go down Constitution Avenue, and there's the Federal Reserve in front, and he said, "Let that window on the top floor, all the way to the left, is the money supply room. That's where they make these decisions, apparently." Now, how they go about it, and I said, "Well, wait a minute. If that's the money supply room, so if you wanted to, commit a heist, that's where you'd go." Well, no, there's no money there, but that's where they make these decisions. Now, I assume that Jerome Powell talks to other central bank presidents around the world. God, in Canada, we have a prime minister now who's been a president or in charge of a central bank in both UK and Canada. But I assume that's how some of these decisions are made.
Well, I mean, they have massive. I mean, for those, without getting into huge detail here, if you were to tell somebody, I mean, if you were God and running the place, if you were to say, look, I want to keep the money supply growth within 0.5% of the real growth, because I don't really want any inflation or deflation. If you were to give somebody that assignment, just to do that is a hard thing to do. Because, yeah. I think you probably know, but this is I don't want to give a monetary theory class here in 5 minutes, but I guess I'll take a minute to do it. And in this country, we are set up at a point where essentially people, because of the way the banking system's set up, people can create money. Now you say, how the hell is that going to happen? Well, if I go in and I put $1 million in a bank, which I don't have to do, but if I did, I walk in and drop in $1 million. There's something called a reserve requirement, which we used to have. I don't even know if we have one anymore, which is crazy. But let's say the reserve requirement was 20%, which it was all during my college and graduate school years. That means if Wayne walked in for the money supply is defined as deposits in the banks, cash in circulation. Now, if I brought in cash and put it in there, okay, now that's not, I didn't raise the money supply because I had the cash, okay? But if I sold my house and, the long story is, if Wayne comes in and borrows $800,000 and turns around and puts that $800,000 back in the bank, there's now $1.8 million in the money supply. Now, the next guy can borrow $640,000 of Wayne's $800,000 if the reserve requirements. So now that goes in whatever, what's that, five something something. Now the money supply increase. So if the economy is growing and people are borrowing and like put the money back in the money supply is going to grow on its own because of the way our system is set up. So in those cases, the Fed may actually have to retard the system to maintain a 2% growth. They have to actually go in and sell bonds, because if they sell bonds to somebody, now the money comes out of somebody's bank account and goes into the Fed, so it comes out of the system, essentially comes out of the pool, right, Wayne? And if all of a sudden things are slowing down, they might want to buy bonds because they inject some money into the system. So their job is to maintain the pool in a level at which the money supply grows at the rate they want it to grow. Correct? So, I mean, which doesn't mean they're always pouring money in. Sometimes they might have to be taking it out, right, to maintain it. Am I correct?
Yeah, I wonder how with the supply chain issues now, because, you know, there's the port of Long Beach, for example, which takes in all these containers from China. You got these corporate and independent operator truckers just sitting there waiting for containers, and there's really not much coming in right now. And of course, where does this stuff go? It goes to Walmart, it goes to Target, and Costco, and if there's nothing on the shelves, like we saw during COVID, to some extent, toilet paper, what does that do to the overall economy? You're sitting at home and scrimping and doing what you can to survive, and it's got to have an impact, because you know what happens when people just aren't buying as much.
Well, that's a problem. But I mean, that really doesn't affect. If anything, that would cause the money supply to drop, because you're not getting as many.
Yeah.
And people aren't borrowing, but now people are borrowing on credit cards. Okay, because they don't have the money. But
with huge interest rates, buying groceries on credit. Yeah.
Well, and because the complexity of this problem is, that's why I talk about it just a little bit, because I can tell pretty well from my education simple stories about what happened if you just did one thing, Wayne. The only problem is nobody can just do one thing, right? I mean, that's the problem. I mean, so this stuff is amazingly complex, and whenever you hear somebody tell you how simple it is, it's not. But you know, I wonder, while you were here, I had a question. I did a we got 5 minutes. I was you know anybody at the Heritage Group?
Oh, I've been to some seminars that they'd hold at lunchtime there. I knew that what their politics were, but I always said, well, I'm going to go to that because it's a lunch over the lunch hour, and they always have a pretty nice spread of food over there because you know they get a lot of money. So yeah, I'd stick around for the sandwich, you know. but yeah, they've actually gotten even more right wing than they were 15, 20 years ago when I used to go over there to listen to speakers. they're not the same Heritage Foundation anymore.
Well, I mean, I've read some of the papers they put out lately, and I'll tell you, I mean, I don't really care what side they are of the aisle. Those guys write pretty well, and they have a lot of stuff regarding history. And I mean, one guy did a 10-page thing on inflation, which took us all the way back to Civil War.
Yeah.
Which is by far the best summary I've ever heard about it. But I was reading one last week regarding tariffs, and it was pretty much the whole history of tariffs, starting with Jefferson. And I did not realize the Civil War almost started 20 years earlier because over tariffs.
Yeah.
Because the North and the South had two totally different economies, and one was for tariffs, right, and one wasn't.
And remember, Heritage, they are the authors of Project 2025. Now, they've got that group, and then there's the Cato Institute, which is another group that's well-funded up there. And I've been, actually, they used to have late afternoon seminars, and I'd stick around not only for the free food, but they'd always have they'd pop the wine bottles. You get a couple of drinks there before you head to the bar. But anyway, the Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank. Of course, they're totally opposed to tariffs.
Well, what this guy was saying is that, I guess it's a right-wing group, but he said that one of the best, single best things for worldwide growth in economics was the general treatment on tariffs and trade and the World Trade Organization. He said, because absolutely that was the biggest plus we've had in the last 100 years.
Wow.
But then he said the one fly in the ointment was that somehow or another was a Clinton, I believe, let China in. And he goes, they've never obeyed any of the rules. They do the stuff so cheap because they use slave labor and everything else that they've kind of depressed other people's economies, but because, you know, I kind of added this to it, because salaries here have not kept up with prices for really 20, 25, 30 years, our society is so dependent on essentially blue jeans from China and shot glasses from China. Not only is it throwing people out of work here, but also families can't afford stuff from anywhere else.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, I'm sitting there going, you know, this guy's pretty spot on, even though I don't really know his politics. I don't care. It just seemed.
Yeah.
He said that the China, he made it sound like Trump was wrong going against everybody and making tariffs this big thing, but he wasn't right about singling. He was pretty right about singling out China. And I'm not sure I don't agree with that. I think I do.
Yeah. Well, when I was in China a few years back, I was told that they actually have Walmarts over there. I really wanted to go to one. To see,
God.
You know, I mean, just think about walking into a Walmart in China where all the stuff's from China. And, you know, what kind of prices do you pay over there? So, you know, Walmart may be hurting for sales here, but they're certainly not hurting for sales at their places in China.
Well, Russell claims that, I mean, he's kind of our China expert. Not kind of, he is. And he says he doesn't think anybody's ever made any money over there because they make you pay so much essentially for protection, plus the place has to own 50%, yeah. 51% of your business. He goes, I don't know if anybody has ever made a lot of dough over there as a company.
Yeah. So what happened with China, of course, is when, you know, they still call themselves the People's Republic of China, and the Communist Party is the only one in charge, but it's a hyper capitalist with a society with strong state control, of course, and it's, you know, when I was in Beijing, I remember I had a copy of Mao's Little Red Book, but I lost it over the years, and I want to go get another one. I was asking people in the bookstore, hey, do you have any copies of Mao's Little Red Book? They didn't know what I was talking about. They had Jacqueline Suzanne novels, Tom Clancy, Dan Brown, God, all out there. And the guy said, I don't know. He said, let me look it up in the computer. And he said, what's the name again? I said, Mao.
Well, I know at one point there were allegedly more pictures of the colonel from Kentucky Fried than Mao left over there.
Yeah, there was even a picture taken of Tiananmen Square where they have a big portrait of Mao in the front, and somebody took a picture where further down they had Colonel Sanders, and in the background they had Mao on the same photo.
God. Well, Wayne, thank you very much, buddy. How come you didn't go up to Andrew's thingy?
Well, you know, I don't want to rain on his it's his thing, and I mean, it's I guess he's going to be with a lot of guys from his graduating or his class back in college.
Admit it, you're intimidated by a bunch of guys from the Ivy League.
Yeah, because, you know, I went to the University of Mississippi, and although they tried to tell me it was considered the Harvard of the South, I never bought that either.
I thought that was Vanderbilt. Everybody uses that. I thought that was Vanderbilt. They use that term,
right,
too. S&P
futures,
S&P futures up 12, NASDAQ futures up 37. Thank you very much, Jimmy. Thank you. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.